Welcome to the Messy Walk Podcast with Pastor Adam Cook, where our goal is to have a genuine and authentic conversation about the Christian faith journey and what a messy walk with Jesus really looks like. Make sure to follow us for future episodes that will be posted regularly each Wednesday. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hey, welcome to the Messy Walk Podcast. I'm your host, Steph, here at Pastor Adam.
Hey.
It has been a minute since we last spoke.
That is a good way to put it.
Just want to put that out there. It's now February.
Yeah, our last episode came out on January the 21st, I believe.
Yes, and we recorded before that.
Yes, exactly. So it's been a while, and the delay was mainly weather related.
Oh yeah.
We try to record on Mondays, and sometimes it's not Monday, but most of the time it's Monday. Like today is a Monday. And we had ice apocalypse, and we had Snowmageddon, and
like I had a lot of people got
I had some traveling and stuff, so we have been really out of the habit. So we're trying right now to get back into the habit. This is probably this time frame that we just missed is probably the longest gap we've had in the history of this podcast.
I think it is as well.
I think it probably is, because it's right at a month where we haven't had any new episodes, which is almost never happens. We'll go 2 weeks sometimes, but hardly ever. Most of the time we're recording about 48 episodes a year, not counting the little Happy New Year stuff or stuff like that. Right.
Yeah.
So we're recording somewhere between 45, 48 episodes a year. And so far this year we are behind. Right. So it's just kind of the way it went down. And it also went down in the middle of a series. Right. So which I don't like. So we may end up shortening the series. So Steph, what have we been talking about, if you can even remember? Because we kicked this thing off prior to Christmas.
Yeah,
we
did.
And we're still in it, right? So what have we been talking about so we can get back on track? By the way, though, this episode today and the one for next week I think are really good and really helpful to get us back on track. But and I'm going to nerd out on them when we get to them. But what have we been talking about?
So the series is called Lies Satan Tells You About Scripture.
Yeah, so we've been covering the fact that the enemy lies to us to keep us out of the Word. And these have all been, so far, they've all been relatively short episodes. Today's won't be, and the one for next week won't be either. But they've all been pretty short. And they're just quick little succinct lies that the enemy says that then ends up keeping us out of the Word. And the way we kicked this series off was saying, you know, the Word tells us that you and I can recognize the lies of the enemy, right? And so we can see how he's lying to us and why he would be doing that, because he's trying to keep us out of the truth. He's trying to keep us out of the Word. And so we've just been kind of debunking those. So the first one was, you know, the fact that you already know it. And we kind of hit back real quick episode and said, actually, you don't. That's not really a good excuse at all. The other one is nobody can understand it. And we talked about how that's not accurate at all, because even children can understand the vast majority of Scripture, and especially the main theological points. And then the third episode, which I think would have been like 231 or so, that was after Christmas and New Year's, was that it's boring. And that was a fun one.
That was a quick one, right?
That was a fun one, because if there's anything the Bible is not, it's boring, right? That just means that you ain't reading it, because it is like a... You remember those Spanish soap operas, right? The telenovelas?
Yes.
We used to have to watch those in Spanish class in high school. You have to do that?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, we used to have to watch them. The teacher would put on the telenovela in the Spanish class, and then we would all fall asleep watching it. The Bible is sort of like a telenovela. That might sound like heresy, but it is. It's like it's anything but boring. That was the third one. And then number four, we talked about that, you know, Satan will say, some thought to get you to think, well, it's better left to the professionals, that the professionals are the only ones that can understand it, and we debunked that thought. And then the last one we did, which was a month ago, was intelligent people don't read the Bible anymore. That was a fun one, too, because, and I don't even know if you remember it, Steph, but we talked about some of the most highly intelligent people in the world who read and study the Bible. As a matter of fact, we talked about the guy who has the highest recorded IQ in the world.
Yeah,
who talks about the fact that the Bible is real, and that God is God. It's just pretty cool. And so we've just been debunking those. And so the ones we want to get to today and next week are centered around the accuracy of Scripture. So what's today's lie that the enemy will tell us to keep us out of the Word, Steph?
Well, First, our episode is 234.
There you go. Thank you.
Because you were already saying all the numbers.
Yeah, I said a few of those numbers, right? 234.
So 234 in the sixth law is the English Bible was not translated correctly.
Yes. So as a pastor, I hear this all the time. And I bet most people who interact with people who are not followers of Jesus, right? Especially those who have a little bit of angst against Christians. That this gets affirmed a lot, right? And this gets tossed around a whole lot. Well, you know, the Bible has been translated so many times, it's got to be completely unreadable, unreliable by now. And the English Bible is not something that you can really study because it's not reliable in its translation. And then also, like next week, this leads into the one next week, that it's contradictory. So we're going to hit both of those over the next 2 weeks. And so this is definitely a lie that I think Satan propagates among, especially amongst people who are not believers, of why they shouldn't trust the word. And so we just want to kind of go through, and this will be fast. This is not in depth, but we're going to give you some points, some talking points, and something you can sort of understand about Bible translation. Okay, so this idea is that the Bible's been translated from language to language to language, so is no way it can be trustworthy. Well, let's debunk that a little bit. The Bible was written in three different languages, two of them primarily, one of them is a secondary little bit of it, not much, is the Hebrew. The majority of the Old Testament is written in Hebrew. There's a small part of the Old Testament that is Aramaic, but only a small part. And then the New Testament is written in Greek, because Greek was the common language of the time, right? Even though the majority of your New Testament was written by people who were Jewish and spoke Hebrew, they wrote it in Greek because that was the language of the time, and they all knew Greek for the most part, right?
Wow.
So those are the three languages. Modern translations, so the translations of the Bibles that you and I have, the one you can go buy at the store, the one that's on your bookshelf, the one that's home on your nightstand that you never read, modern translations are not translated from other English versions, right? So this theory is known as a telephone game theory. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Telephone game, right? You ever did that when you were a kid, right? Where you got a bunch of people and somebody says something to somebody's ear and then they keep saying it. And then by the time it gets to the end, it don't make no sense. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, you just made me think of the movie Madagascar 2.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, the chimps and everything, they're like all hooked on the arm and they're like, pass this up there.
Yes, exactly.
It's the wrong message at the end.
And it ends with it. So the thought is that it's just a bunch of so the Bible that we have that we can buy right now, right?
Yeah.
You go buy a copy. It's just language to language to language to language to language. Like it went from Hebrew to Greek, then it went from Greek to German, then it went from German to English. Then you know what I mean? Then the English version that we have is like 75 different English versions translated against each other. That is not the case. They actually, your modern translations that you have, they go back to and they're translated from the original languages.
That's good to know.
And so English Bibles that you and I would have, they are based on ancient source documents, not layers of translation. So let's start off there, right? So that sort of takes the telephone game thing theory out of the mix. That's not accurate at all.
Yeah, that's comforting.
The amount of so they're coming from ancient manuscripts, okay? The amount of ancient manuscript evidence is massive, right? And I mean like massive on a scale more than any other literature in the history of the world, all right? So there are over 5,000, actually the number is about 5,800 Greek New Testament manuscripts. Some of those are whole, some of those are partial, right? Some of those are sections, but there are 5,800 of them. There are thousands more that are also in Latin, in Syriac, and in Coptic languages, right? So if you compare that to other ancient literature that was consistently copied, like, for example, Homer's Iliad, right? There are far, far more Greek New Testament translations than there are manuscripts than there are of Homer's stuff, or even way, way more than Plato's. So, like, Homer's Iliad is somewhere around 1,700 copies, right, of ancient manuscripts. Well, the Greek New Testament is 5,800, right? There are far more Greek manuscripts of the New Testament than any other ancient literature ever, right? Like far more, exponentially more. And remember, we are translating our Bibles from those ancient manuscripts, right? And so the more manuscripts we have, the easier it is to determine scribal errors and all those kind of things to ensure the validity of the translations. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does.
Right? So I would venture to say, maybe I'm saying this too early in the podcast, but it's just the way it goes, I'm talking. I would venture to say that out of everything we've ever translated in human history, the thing that you can trust the most in accurate translation is the Bible that we have. Because of the sheer volume of ancient manuscripts we have and how they hold true through all these centuries. So let me also make this important clarification. There are some textual variants, right? There are some variants that you'd see in these ancient manuscripts and then also in the translations that we have now, which is why we have different translations. We're going to get to that in a few minutes. But the majority of these textual variations, so if you look at some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were, when they were found in the 20th century, they were 1,000 years older than anything we had, right? When you look at some of those, you do see some textual variants from stuff that's like, for example, there's some ancient manuscripts that are all the way back to 100 BC of almost all of Paul's letters. You do see some variations in it, right? There's some things that are a little bit different. But the majority of them are spelling differences, right, where words are spelled differently. Just like if me and you sat down and wrote the exact same thing, we would probably spell some stuff differently, right? You know, because I can't remember whether the I comes before E in the word weird, so I always mess it up. And it doesn't stand true to the whole I before E after C thing, right? And you might remember that weird is spelled the correct way. It's E-W-E-I-R-D, I believe is the right one. So you might do it right. There's some spelling differences. And then some of them are word order differences, where the words are put in order in a different way. And then some of them are grammatical shifts, like where there is it is grammatically set up differently in one particular text, ancient manuscript text, than it is in another. But here's the key. When you look at these variants, no core Christian doctrine hinges on any disputed text, right? So these core Christian doctrines have held true, right? The majority of them have held true for as long as we've ever been translating the Bible. Does that make sense? So yeah, you can see that, well, this particular text, this ancient text that was discovered when at whatever time has a different word spelled this way, different grammatical usage, or the words are a different order. But none of that is something that disputes these core Christian theologies that we have and these core things that have stayed consistent all the way through these translations. So let me talk just for a second about how biblical translation really works. All right. So there are three, kind of four, primary translation philosophies. All right. This is how you're going to get the translations that you use. So what Bible translation do you use primarily, Steph?
The English Standard Version.
English Standard. Okay.
What about you?
Now, I use the NIV primarily. Yeah. And then that's what we teach from as well. All right. So English Standard, NIV, KJV, King James Version. We got a whole section on that in here. King James Version, New King James Version, right? Oxford Annotated Bible. There's a gazillion of them, right? New American Standard, right? There's a ton. There's three, kind of four, philosophies of translation. The first one is known as formal equivalence. The easy way to remember that one is word for word, right? So, for example, your English Standard Version is a word for word translation. All right, the way those work is that they are trying to stay as close to possible as the original wording and structure, right? And so they are trying to take the text, and this particular philosophy of translation is we're going to use our words that match their words, word for word, as best we can, all right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that sometimes you do words that way, but our words don't match up correctly. And then you end up missing the thought behind it, right? The big picture thought, because you're going for words. But that's a translational philosophy, right? The next one is known as dynamic equivalence, and this is instead of word for word, this is thought for thought. So, mm-hmm. In the best example of this, the most widely used is the NIV.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's happening in the NIV in this dynamic equivalence or thought for thought is the aim here is to communicate the meaning that is happening in it, the thought that's there, clearly in our language, right? Hmm. Instead of it being, let me clarify each word exactly how it is, right? We want to make sure. So when you take this particular philosophy, they're going, it's better for us to communicate the overall thought that's happening than it is each specific word, right? It's funny, though, when you compare these two, if you sit down and look at them side by side, you'll notice that they're extremely similar, right? Because most of the time, you can translate something word for word and get the thought across, right, mm-hmm. with our language. And sometimes you can translate the thought and still match the wording appropriately. There is one other philosophy. Well, there's another one. There's one other philosophy that is sort of a combined version of these two. I think it's called combined equivalence. And so it is combining the, let's look at word for word, and let's also look at thought and make sure that they are matching up appropriately, right? Then that makes the most sense. But most translations are found in these two things, right? So, for example, the KJV is like the English Standard. It's a word-for-word formal equivalence. Here's the problem with both of these. Sometimes you can take a word-for-word translation and completely miss the thought, like we said a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, you can translate the word. So in the Greek New Testament, they had four different words for love. We have the same word for love, right? So sometimes we can misappropriate that translation and miss the thought if we just go for word translation, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we have only one word for love. You can say that before you and Jonathan got here tonight, what did you eat?
Taco Bell.
Taco Bell, right? So you can say,
whoops, y'all.
You can say, I love Taco Bell, right? I love Taco Bell. I would say, I love pizza. But then if I wanted to talk about my wife, or if you want to talk about Jonathan, your husband, you say, I love Jonathan.
And that's different, yeah.
And that's different, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. It's vastly different, right? Vastly different. So the reason that, word-to-word translations sometimes have issues is because they will miss the thought just by grabbing the word. Well, the same concept exists in reverse with dynamic equivalence, is that sometimes you will use the thought and you'll grab the thought, but you're not going back to the language appropriately, and then maybe possibly the person who's translating the thought can introduce their own bias or interpret the wording wrong. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right? So I could be going for, like with yours, it could be, and I only say yours because that's the one you said you read primarily,
me.
Right?
Yeah.
So you could end up picking the wrong love word, miss the thought. Well, I could read it and assume that the love you were talking about was Taco Bell love, right? And try to get that thought across when really you were talking about Jonathan type love, right?
So that makes sense. Yeah.
So that's just the difference in the two.
Wow.
But if you put them side by side, you will notice that they are, I mean, the people get so upset and crazy about certain little pieces of this. And I'm telling you, I don't think it's just for argument's sake. I think it's because the enemy is trying to get us to doubt the validity of the translations that we have. Because when you do this, when you put them side by side, 99% of it is exactly the same.
Yeah.
Right? Whether it's coming from a word from word or a formal equivalence or a dynamic equivalence, thought for thought. Then you've got the combined one we talked about a minute ago. And then you have what we know as a paraphrase. So, like, for example, a paraphrase translation would be The Message, right? That's probably the most famous paraphrase translation that there is. That is not a strict translation. It is not following word-by-word thought. It is not following dynamic thought. It is paying the most attention to how can this be the most readable for the reader in their current context. The reason that the trouble that you'd have with a paraphrase is sometimes the paraphrase translations are based on other translations instead of the ancient text. Not all of it. Like The Message is still looking at ancient text.
Mm-hmm.
But then the problem you have with it too is if you're trying to give it if readability is your main issue, then 20 years from now, that language isn't going to make any sense to the person reading it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right? Like, for example, there is right now out multiple Gen Z Bibles, right? Where they've taken this and they've tried, and they're mainly humorous, but you know they're funny. But they've taken all this weird Gen Z language, you know, like lying is cap, right? You know what mm-hmm. I mean? You're capping, and they're using that language in there. Well, if you fast forward 20 years, or you go backwards, if Steph sits down or I sit down, we're older and we read it, we're like, I don't know what the crap this is talking about. Is it talking about a hat on their head when it says cap? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't know what this means. So that's where you get into some issues with that. So the vast majority of translations that you and I are going to look at are one of these main three. And really, it's one of the main two. It's word-for-word translation, it's thought-for-thought translation, or it's a combined, you know, combination of that, right? That is how these things. And so the differences between English Bibles that you would have in your hand, they usually reflect translation philosophy, not corruption, right? So when you get your hands on an NIV and you go, all right, there's some differences in this in the KJV, the NIV must be corrupted. Or there's some differences in the KJV and the NIV, the KJV must be corrupted. It's not true. It's a philosophy in the translation. It's not corrupted, right? It's not something that is translated incorrectly, right? It's just a different philosophy in how to translate it. And like I said, once again, if you put them side by side, they're almost always virtually the same, right? In 99% of situations and circumstances. And then people will go, well, but Pastor, what about these missing verses? When I look at KJV or I look at NIV, certain ones have certain verses that are left out or omitted. Some modern Bibles leave out or omit or footnote certain scriptures, right? So, for example, if you look at a word-for-word translation like your ESV, you will find various different spots where there is a verse there. And if you compare that to, say, the NIV, which is what I primarily use, primarily teach from, what I'm studying, by the way, and in my sermon prep, I'll use four or five different ones, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm primarily teaching from the NIV. I like the language and I like the thought capture. Anyway, when you look at that and you go, well, there's one that's in here, there's this one's in here for the KJV or the ESV, and it's not in here for the NIV, what does that mean? Well, the reason that those are there is because older manuscripts sometimes lack those verses. And so what scholars end up doing is they prioritize the earlier manuscripts and the multiple independent sources. And then what you'll see a lot of times is it's footnoted. So the NIV will consistently footnote, for example, and go, this is in certain manuscripts, it's not found in all, right? And it'll let you know. Or it'll say, this is in certain manuscripts, but it's not found in the earliest ones. So the question that the translators have is not, is it valid? It's we don't know whether this was added or if it just was accidentally omitted in when people were hand transcribing all of these things, right? Does that make any sense?
Yes.
So what that does, don't let that then say, oh, the Bible has been corrupted, it's not reliable in these translations. No, what that actually tells you is that it's reflecting greater accuracy, not removal of truth. It's trying to be accurate and tell you that this is in certain ones, it's not in others, right? So does that make sense?
Yeah, I keep picturing like a textbook too, like for school, you know?
Absolutely.
Do they still have textbooks?
This is scholarly approach to Bible translation. So, and so sometimes the translators will go, there is enough evidence that we will keep this verse in here just like it is. And then there's other translational philosophies that'll go, we don't quite know exactly, so we're going to footnote this one, right? There's nothing wrong with that at all, right? And I find what I'm trying to say is that that doesn't validate this claim that you can't trust the English translation of the Bible. What it does is it ends up validating the fact that you can, right? Because it is giving you accuracy as opposed to just going, this is truth, this is not truth. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So here comes the King James question, right? So there are lots of people who say, we only can trust the King James and everything else is wrong. The King James Version of the Bible was groundbreaking in 1611 when it came out. 1611 was when this translation happened. Groundbreaking, right? It was the official translation of the Church of England at the time, obviously authorized by King James. And so it was a groundbreaking translation because it tried to resolve some issues between a couple of earlier translations. But here's the issue with the King James. It's based on, when it was translated in 1611, it's based on fewer manuscripts than we have in our hands today. There have been discoveries of lots and lots and lots, probably about 1,000 or so different. Like, for example, one of the biggest examples is the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? So the Dead Sea Scrolls, when we found those, when humans found those, they predated by 1,000 years the earliest manuscripts that we had at the time of the Old Testament. And so when the King James came out in 1611, those didn't exist, right? So one of the reasons why, you know, why you would say, okay, is the King James is accurate is, well, no, because it's not based on the full mound of evidence that we have right now. It's beautiful language. It's worded great. It's in this amazing sort of not quite Old English, but Old English type language. It's beautiful, but it's not based on the earliest textual evidence that's available now. And so when you look at something that's a modern translation, like, for example, the New King James Version, right? Mm-hmm. The New King James Version, those modern translations, they aren't changing the Bible, right? So when you read the ESV, the NIV, the NASB, when you read all these, and then the New King James, when you read them, they're not changing the Bible at all. They're correcting things based on better data, right? Based on the compilation of more and more manuscripts. Here's what's amazing about all this is that those 5,800 plus manuscripts that we have of the Greek New Testament, when these biblical scholars are studying all these things and linguists, they are almost perfectly accurate to each other, right? Even though they've been hand translated for so long, absent of some, you know, like we said before, some grammar errors, some spelling things, you know what I mean? Like absent of some of that, they are crazy. And so the vast amount of them that you have, the more accurate it gets, right? So the fact that now modern translations are based on the collectiveness of all of these manuscripts that we have, these ancient manuscripts, the more we have makes it more accurate, not less accurate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So one of the ways that you can be confident in what I'm saying, right, that you can be confident in the fact that your modern translations are extremely accurate, right, the most accurate we've ever had, are two reasons. The first one is scholarship, and the second one is transparency. When we talk scholarship, translation committees, they include Hebrew scholars, Greek scholars, historians, linguists, I mean, philosophers. They include a whole plethora of people. So none of these translations are one person sitting in their basement who knows a whole lot of Greek and Hebrew translating these Bibles, right?
Yeah.
This is a scholarly committee, and it is published. You can look at it, and it is vast. I mean, these translation committees are hundreds and hundreds of people, right, from all of these backgrounds. So we're talking scholarship. And many of these translations, they represent different denominations, right? So it's not got some denominational bias in it.
Oh, that's right? Cool. Yeah.
So if you take a look at the translation committee, the compilation committee for the NIV, you will notice people from almost every denominational background that are also Hebrew scholars, Greek scholars, linguists, ancient historian, biblical time historians, right? Biblical time philosophers, all those kind of things mixed in with. So scholarship helps us understand the fact that we can trust this. The other one, and I think this is my favorite one, the other one is transparency, all right? So how do you know that your modern English Bible can be trusted in its translation? Well, a big part of that is the fact that they're extremely transparent about it. Translation notes and textual variants are openly published, mm-hmm. right? So you can actually see all of their notes and all of their thoughts and all the things that are going on with this translation. It's not hidden. Does that make sense?
That's, you know what I mean? Cool, yeah.
So it's not something that's hidden. You can go find it. And so if corruption were happening, if we were trying to change something in the Bible, right, it would be publicly challenged immediately. But what you see is you see all the notes and all the reasons. So if a particular verse gets footnoted that wasn't before, right? This has happened a lot now over the years with the original King James translation to modern translations across the board. You'll see that all of a sudden something that was in the original King James is now a footnoted verse. Well, you can find the actual reasons and the textual variations and their translation notes that tell you why they did that. And what they'll do is they will reference in detail, this is found in this text, this text, this text, this text. This is found in this manuscript, but it's not found in these older manuscripts that we think were more complete, right? And so because there's this older manuscript that's more complete, and there's several of them that carry this key thought, that's why we've now moved this particular verse that's found in the 1611 King James to a footnote instead of it being in there, right? So you, what I'm saying is the transparency of the translational committee is amazing. So they're scholarly, but at the same time, they're showing you what they're doing, and it's out, it's public, right? So nobody's trying to hide something. Nobody's trying to corrupt the Bible, right? These translations that we have now are incredible, right? And they are incredible because of the scholarly approach, because of the transparency, but then also because of the sheer volume of ancient texts we have now to look at to be able to translate it, right?
Wow.
The volume of them that we have. And so let me just recap for a second and we'll move on. The Bible is one of the most well-attested ancient documents in history. By far, right? There are no other ancient documents that we have that have more ancient texts and manuscripts than of the Bible. Modern English translations are based on ancient manuscripts. So your modern translation is not based on one that happened 20 years ago, right? Somebody didn't sit down and go, let me take the King James Version from 1611 and let me translate that again now and call it the NIV. That's not happening. They're going back to the ancient text. The differences between the versions, they reflect translational philosophy, not corruption, right? So the fact that the Bible that you primarily read, Steph, is a little bit worded a little bit differently, it's got a little bit different variation than the one I read, is not because one of the two of them's corrupt. It's because there's just a different philosophy in how this is being translated, right?
Yeah.
And even those stay pretty true to each other. And then, like I said before, scholars are transparent about the fact that there are variants in the scripture.
That's good.
And in the text, right? Mm-hmm. And so, closing point here, you can debate interpretation if you want to, but there's no possible way to honestly say that the English Bible is carelessly translated, right? It is one of the most carefully translated documents that's ever existed. And what's cool about it is it continues to be, right? So there are all of these modern translations that you're looking at. There are also revisional committees and revisional parts that come out, right, that then update it based on new things that are found, right, or errors that are found.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So there are revisions that are constantly been found because, oh, we found an error in this. We found that we put this word in and it was wrong. It was an accident. And so, or we found some new manuscripts. We need to go back and take a look and make sure this fits. There's revisional committees happening all the time that go along with this. Like you can argue the interpretation all you want to. That's always up for debate. If you know Hebrew and Greek and have your hands on all these ancient manuscripts, right? Which I don't know anybody who does outside of these committees and people. You can argue that, but there's just no possible way. Like, it is a dumb TikTok argumentative statement, right, to say that the English Bible can't be trusted because it's translated incorrectly. It's just not true, right? It's highly inaccurate. We're talking about the most accurately translated piece of literature the world has ever seen. There have been more eyes on the Bible and its translation than any other document in the world, right? So you just this just doesn't hold water. And I really do think that it's not just people being contrarian when they want to bring this up, right? I really do think it's the enemy trying to keep us out of the scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways he can keep us out of it is if he invalidates it, right? If he says you can't trust it, and you can't trust it because of this and this and this. You can't trust it because it's, you know, it's translated by people and it's not accurate and there's all these different versions. I think that he is trying to, by saying it's not translated correctly, it's just one of the lies of the enemy that's trying to keep us out of the word, right?
Yeah.
So what I say to you is if you're reading and this ever comes up in your mind, right, you're checking out the Bible, you're reading, because the people who aren't reading the Bible, I'm not even talking to you, right? Like, I'm not trying to be ugly. I'm just saying, if you're saying you can't trust the Bible and you never even reading it, you're not reading it, you never read it, well, where are we having a conversation? So if you find yourself reading the Bible and you notice that, okay, well, this is in the footnote, why is this here? Well, study it, right? And you'll see the reasons that are behind those things and that it is trustworthy. And one of the reasons it's trustworthy is because you see stuff like that. So anyway, I just think that it's a lie of the enemy that keeps us from reading the scripture. And you do not need to study extensively. You can, but you don't need to study extensively whether or not you can trust these modern translations, right? You can. And we just gave you a quick rundown, right? We could talk about this all day long. Matter of fact, when Stephanie's husband saw this, saw these notes, he got excited because he wanted to Bible nerd out on it because it's a really cool thing. It's a really cool thing. I think it's amazing. You know, my favorite thing of everything we've said today, my favorite thing about it is how much sheer volume of ancient texts we have of the New Testament, of specifically the Gospels. It's mind-blowing, mm-hmm. right? And that, to me, we're not really getting into this in this particular topic, but that, to me, is yet again more proof that Jesus is who he says he is. There is massive historical evidence. Like, there is more historical evidence for the existence of Jesus than any other ancient person you can name, by far. So, anyway... That's all we got for this one. I thought this one was pretty cool.
The next one will
kind of come into this because we're going to talk about contradictions, right? Because mm-hmm. That's another lie the enemy tells us is that, you know, the Bible is just full of contradictions, so don't read it, right? And that's just not true either. So it's actually not true at all. There's some stuff that's hard, but it doesn't mean it's a contradiction. And so don't let this be the reason that you don't read the Bible. Right. And when you end up in a discussion with somebody who brings it up, you know, it's probably somebody who is not a believer. Right. Has some issues with God, has some issues with the church, has some issues with the Bible. And they bring up you can't trust it. You should be able to kind of clearly communicate. That's just not true at all. And a quick Google search will come back and show you all the exact same stuff I just said. Just like that. Right. Just like that. So be confident in the fact that you can trust the modern translation of the Bible that you have in your hand. And if you're questioning, well, should I be doing the word for word or the thought for thought? It doesn't matter. I use all of them. They're both completely fine. So anyway.
That was great.
Don't let the enemy lie to you about this. This is a stupid one. Right? Yeah. I'd rather you believe that the Bible is boring before you believe this one. So don't believe this lie. It's just a lie.
Don't.
It's just a lie. He's trying to keep us out.
Don't.
He's trying to keep us up. Maybe we should have did a series on lies the enemy tells us to keep us from recording our podcast for 4 weeks.
Well, well, the storms won't lie. You were also sick.
I was. All right.
All righty. Well, it's really good to be back, and we look forward to talking to y'all next week.
See you soon.
See ya.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on the Messy Walk Podcast with Pastor Adam Cook. Make sure to follow us for future episodes that will be posted regularly each Wednesday. Have a good day.